this morning with the sundown shining in him.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
Found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis.
I hate Illinois Nazis.
Now, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sun down.
Well, North Bay Stacks and Jacks. I'm talking about Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures up 39. NASDAQ Futures up 151. This is after a horse bleep week in the market. We'll see if this is a real bounce or a dead cat bounce. Hopefully, just as a way of review, Friday Dow was down 410, S&P down 95. Yeah, 95. NASDAQ down 436, so we're back about a third of it, all this, and we'll see if it holds. Maybe it will, hopefully it will. If not, I don't think it's going to look too good technically. I'm not a technical guy. You're more of a technical guy than me, Greg. I won't say a technical analyst, but a technical guy, you know, just saying.
We got some, what do we have this week? There's GME earnings, I know that. That controls a lot of sentiment among the meme stocks.
Yeah, there's a few earnings coming by, and... obviously, everybody's still worried about NVIDIA. It's
we got the Apple iPhone event today.
And what do you make of that?
Well, iPhone 16, so we'll see what they got. Hopefully, maybe some battery improvements.
Have you seen this, how do you pronounce it, Huawei? H-A-U?
Huawei.
Tri-fold phone gets 2.7 million pre-orders ahead of Apple's. Ever seen one of these tri-fold phones?
I've seen the Samsung one that folds.
Into three or two?
I think it's two.
I've only seen the twos.
But, you know, not exactly my thing, but it's pretty cool to look at.
Well, you know, if it becomes cool for other people, it'll become cool for you. You know how you are.
And Oracle earnings today?
Yeah, a bunch of stuff.
And then the government stuff on Wednesday and Thursday, the CPI and PPI.
So we're loaded.
Which we love, you know.
Which we love. We love being lied to. Just saying.
Yeah.
There is. No. We also got the big debate tomorrow night, right?
Oh, presidential?
Yeah.
Oh, sweet. We have merged entertainment and, governance.
Yeah, I'm not so sure it's a positive thing, but it definitely.
There were some funny memes over the weekend. White dudes for Harris, and it was showing Putin and Dick Cheney.
God.
They were the new white dudes for Harris.
Well, it is sort of interesting the amount of people that have been close to Trump. Just say that, even though they like some of the policies, they can't stand the guy, and he's I won't say deranged, but he's just off his rocker, and you know, I mean, I don't think anybody really likes Harris. This is really messed up when you're voting for the person you.
We get what we deserve.
Well, you know what? That is really kind of the truth in this. I mean, I kind of read this article about how an entire population is.
And if we think it's the politicians that are the problem, I would push back on that.
I would agree with you.
Yeah.
I mean, this thing I read, it has to do with how many people are way out on their heels on their spending and stuff. We got a government's way out on their heels in their spending. Nobody cares.
Right.
It's not like anybody's willing to do anything about it. The weird part is there's somewhere along the line here, you know, and again, I'm in the middle. I'm not going to vote for either one of them, I don't think. But the numbers don't lie. In some place, somewhere, there's tax increase or the
assumption behind the numbers lies.
Right, but I'm saying one of the Trump tax stuff expires in 26, right? I believe.
Well, they're talking about revamping a whole lot.
Well, my point
Harris
is...
wants a percentage in uncapped... Or, and taxes on cap gains.
It should go up.
Unrealized.
It should go up. Oh, unrealized. No, God, no.
And then Trump wants to do away with a lot of the lower income... I want to say just get them bigger tax credits, so...
Kevin says he's not getting our audio on Zoom. Is there something you got to do with Zoom?
Is there something we got to do on Zoom?
So he gets our audio. Are we not in on this end?
We're here.
Because somehow he's in Zoom and he's not hearing us.
Well, we've got... I don't know. Re-log in, Kevin. I'm sure it'll work.
So, yeah, I mean, these numbers, when you get yourself backed into a corner, no matter what... You and your wife's view is on budgeting. When you're broke, right? I mean, nothing serves the truth more than the letter that says, "Hey, you guys are broke," or something along those lines. I mean, why can't we? And this goes back to, and if Kevin manages to come in, I'll ask him this question too. Why can't we do something sane with this capital gains tax? Like move it up to. It should be a discount over ordinary income.
Didn't Trump say he wants to do away with the income tax?
No.
Yeah.
What's he going to do?
He wants to replace it with tariffs.
He's out of his mind. He's absolutely out of his mind.
I think that was the latest.
Okay, but see, now this is all this is when you are talking to, and not just his people. I'm not going to call him what did Hillary call him? I'm not going to do that. But the my question is why the. All right, I'm trying to get this page up here, so I'm stumbling around. When you talk to people, there's an assumption all these politicians are making, and as you probably know, it's the one that bothers the bejesus out of me, is they assume we're all stupid, and I don't know.
That's because we are.
Well, we're not so much stupid when you look up here. And what do you suppose the income tax revenue is for the government?
In billions?
Mm-hmm.
As a percentage of GDP? I don't know.
It's $2 trillion.
Okay.
2.3. What do you suppose the tariff is?
The tariff?
Our tariff tax revenue.
Oh, a lot less than that.
$70 billion.
Yeah.
So it's one God knows what. So tell me how in the hell you're going to get one to equal the other.
Increase it by 97%?
Yeah.
Or no, not 97%.
What do we got to do? What's 70 goes? 70 goes into 23.45, 30 times.
Yeah. So you need to multiply it by 28.
Yeah. I mean, what are we talking about? We have more in excise taxes than we do in tariffs. Excise taxes are $82 billion. Excise taxes come from. Where exactly, other than gasoline, where do they come from? I will look and see here. Excise taxes are gasoline, nearly half of it comes from gasoline. But it's also, tobacco's got excise taxes. What else? Booze?
Smoking? No.
I'm saying tobacco. Cigarettes. Yeah. I think booze. Most of it comes from gasoline and goes right to road repair, right?
In theory.
Well, in theory. Well, it's too
small. Yeah, maybe.
But it's too small to steal. It's only $82 billion. I mean, there's nothing there to steal.
I'll take it.
If you're actually going to... You are fixing roads. Kevin, how are you? Good morning.
Good morning. If the gas tax covers fixing roads, why did we need an infrastructure bill?
Good question. I don't think the gas tax... does new stuff and everything. I mean, it probably should have. It hasn't gone up in a long time, has it? Federal.
Well, but a lot of that infrastructure was supposed to rebuild crumbling bridges over, interstate bridges over rivers. I mean, you name it.
But here, I think
of course,
the red
of course
line
we haven't been fixing them all along, so we need new taxes now to fix them.
We've never maintained normal maintenance of any kind. You know, it's a steel bridge.
Then there must be some reason we're collecting gas taxes.
Well, we're doing some repair. Obviously, we're not doing enough. You know, the one place that absolutely gets, and I don't know if this is federal or, I don't know, Kevin, do you think this is federal or state or both? The place that is absolutely maintained to the highest level is the Golden Gate Bridge. The painters and blasters start at one end. I think it takes them 2 years to get to the other end. And they go right back to the beginning and start all over again. And they just...
What's it cost you to drive over it? What's the toll on it?
No, I'm not sure. It's nothing like New York. I don't see anybody painting those things. That's a good job for Greg. Greg, what is the toll on the Golden Gate, and what is the toll on the Triborough? I'm going to say the Triborough is up to like $15. I'm going to guess the Golden Gate's probably $4, Kevin. With Greg will free. All right. So
I'll bet you it's more than that.
We've got... don't forget, you only pay one way on those things, not twice each way like on the Skyway.
Yeah, so New York, you have to pay to get out?
I'm not sure. I think you got to pay to get in. Then whenever you leave, you leave.
I think you probably do better on getting people who want to get the hell out.
Oh, God. Well, that's a good question. I've gone over the thing 100 times, yet I can't remember.
Cars and two-axle vehicles with no existing license plate account. Wait a second. This is July 1st, 2024. It says 10/25.
For what? Golden Gate?
Yeah.
Wow.
Cars with the Fast Pass or whatever is 9/25.
So they give you a buck discount. Nice of them.
Pedestrians and bikes cross for free.
Only one way, right?
Pedestrians and bikes cross for free.
I know that because I took my bike across.
That is
Kevin, that was a harrowing ride.
I can imagine.
You know, it's up on the bike, you're just kind of high enough where if you really did something stupid, whacking the rail, you just might go over. The rail's not that high. If you're walking along, it's high enough, but it's on a bike, it's, plus it's cold up there, it's windy. And I was up there, wouldn't this be neat? All I did was put my eyes right in front of me and went as steady as I could and couldn't wait to get over the damn thing. It's a nice ride.
Did you ride back?
No. I told you this time, Dr. J and my bro take me on this ride, right? And those two, my brother's a huge bike rider, so of course those two idiots take off and I'm kind of by myself. You gotta go up some huge hill to get up the thing. I mean, you know, obviously San Francisco is nothing but hills. You across it, God's sake, some of the hills going down, you almost would rather would walk. They were so steep. Going up, you had to go off the bike. I mean, I couldn't. You're in the lowest gear. I couldn't go up the thing, and I was in shape. So we get to, name of the town across Sausalito?
Mm-hmm.
So we get to Sausalito, and there's a ferry back to San Francisco, so we're going to take the ferry. And you could also take your bike another, 10 miles or 5 miles or what it was to Tiburon and take the ferry there. So I catch up to these two guys, and they go, hey, come on, let's go. We're going to Tiburon. I said, I understand the ferry starts in Tiburon and comes and stops here, then goes to San Francisco. You see that bar right there? I said, I'm going to go sit in that chair, in that table right out in front of the place and have a nice cold beer. When the ferry comes back, I'll meet you two guys. Maybe we should just stay here. So we ended up having three or four beers waiting for the ferry and put our bikes on the ferry. The ferry ride was pretty cool. It was really nice. I don't know. It wouldn't be something you did every day, let's put it that way. You'd find another place to ride, I think. But it's in California, it's pretty awesome, the scenery and stuff. It just, man, coming from Chicago, it's up, down. It's not like here. I mean,
that's a slight difference, ever so slight difference.
Well, I mean, if everyone, all you got to do in San Francisco, if you're staying in a hotel on like Snob Hill, is go walk a mile in any direction and back, and you got your workout for the month. I mean, you're talking, plus it's, if you're on the side of the street with the sun, you're roasting, and you go to where the shade is, and you're freezing. You got to bring a windbreaker with you wherever you go. It's crazy. But I love it out there. I mean, I think it's pretty cool. But plus, I love the cable cars. I tell you the story when we, I don't forget once, we had to help the guys save the cable car. Walking along the street, I was going to, if you ever want to see something really cool, go to the Cable Car Museum. Anyway, this guy pulls out, they all go to the one spot. It's all this, the cable cars are driven from like three flywheels in one building. They all connect into there. And because you're just turning the cable, hence the name cable car. So the car comes out, and some ditzy babe comes flying out of her garage right in front of the cable car. And for one, if you don't know, the cable car, the braking is all hand braking.
Mm-hmm.
So when a guy pulls on his monster lever, the brake is actually a 2x4. And a 2x4 reaches down and essentially on top and is pressed down to the rail, and the wood has enough friction. Well, this guy's got forearms like Papillon. He's pulling on this thing. He stops just in time to not whack into this babe. But he splits the 2x4 in half. That's how hard he pulled on it. And he gets out, and he's bitching at this lady. And she's like, oh, what do you mean? What do you mean? It was obvious she pulled out right in front of the guy. Anyway, no harm, no foul. But now the guy has got to go back into the cable car place to get a new 2x4. So there's like five of us on the cell line wide. Hey, you guys, how about help? So we ended up pushing the cable car uphill, like about 10 of us, back into the garage. Hey, give us a hand here, will you? There's no way it was going back in the other way because it comes in from another street. So we had to push it kind of uphill into the garage. It was pretty heavy, but we had, you know, a bunch of guys. And, that was pretty cool. Just saying.
It's an experience.
Yeah, just something. I mean, I'm glad he didn't hit her. Those things are heavy.
It's a story that you could tell many years later.
Well, yeah. So what about those Bears? I mean, Chicago is basking in the reflected glory. Defense played well. What is with those guys on the other team with the interceptions? What kind of pass was that guy threw?
I don't know if he thought he could shovel it to his guy over there or if he was just trying to get it out of bounds. You know, it was hard to tell, and I didn't see if anybody asked him afterwards. But for the listeners who may not have seen it, late in the game, and the Bears were still trailing at that point, although they were very much in mid-rally. And it was third down and long, and Tennessee's quarterback, Will Levis, dropped back to pass. He was in the process of getting sacked, and he tried to shovel the ball to the sideline, made for an easy interception and return for a touchdown and the lead for Will Levis, for Tyreek Stevenson. And the Bears won the game by that margin. They converted the two-point conversion, won by 7 points. So I can't, you know, if anybody goes and looks at the highlights online, you'll see him shoveling. But then if instead of watching the ball, watch the quarterback, because he's then on his knees with his hands on his head, like, oh, what have I done?
God. Where did he come from? I don't remember.
He's from Kentucky. He was first-round draft pick last year.
Are the Titans?
He started about half of their games as a rookie last year.
Were the Titans a playoff team last year?
I don't think so.
But they're not bad, right? They're not supposed to.
No, they're not awful. No.
It was a pretty good game last night.
Did you see the post game?
Their defensive line is great, or the Bears' offensive line sucks. But then, man, the center, especially for the Bears, really got manhandled the whole game.
He got knocked on his can a couple times. I saw.
Oh, it was pretty bad. Williams was under duress the whole time. I don't understand why the Bears' offensive coordinator felt compelled to call. Let's see, how many passes did he call? I'm looking at the stats right now. He had him attempt 29 passes. There were three more sacks, so it means he had him attempt 32 passes, and they only ran 22 times. So I don't understand that when you're getting beaten up like that. I guess you're probably not going to run effectively if you can't block either, but at least you can help the guy.
Yeah, did you watch the evening game? And all they kept talking.
I watched the first half, fell asleep, so I didn't see the end. It looked like, from what I saw this morning, it looks like the Rams rallied to the lead and coughed it up at the end and then lost in overtime.
See, now you could have taken a little nap like I did and woke up and still saw it was still going on. Then they did the Mike Tirico was all over the overtime because they just got the ball and went all the way because the other team never got a chance to. But all they did was say how the center is like one of the top three in football, and the one tackle is one of the top three, and the guard is terrific. And I'm sitting there going, they're not saying that about the Bears line. Where did Detroit get all those guys?
And the Bears have they have two high picks on their line that are good players. Tevin Jenkins is good, and of course are the rookie from last time.
The right tackle.
Yeah, the right tackle, which is are very good players. They have more work to do on the line. and a little bit more work to do on the defensive line, although I thought the defensive line played very well yesterday. But otherwise, you know, the Bears have built a pretty good team at most positions. And if you recall where they were 2 years ago, that ain't bad.
I don't think their defensive secondary, including the linebacker core, is second to anybody, really.
No, I mean, you may be able to go find a team and say, well, that one's a little bit better. But, yeah, they're easily top five in the league in the secondary and maybe top three.
Yeah, did you...
The Bears got a win, and that's good. They still have, you know, they're still work in progress. But, you know, every Chicago team won yesterday, actually, and so did the Diamondbacks. So this is, you know, big day for Stocks and Jocks, although the Cardinals may have lost.
What would have I had asked you, or Greg, who's a betting man, what if I had asked you two boys, I'm going to give you a bet that says the Cubs are going to score zero earned runs against the Yankees in a three-game series, but somehow they're going to come out with a win. What odds would you give me on that?
I would tell you that they got swept, but they didn't. Because their pitching is good. I've said to you before, the Cubs have probably squandered more good pitching than any team I've ever seen, because they didn't, you know, for the most part, haven't had to be good. Just good, you know, just decent on offense, and they've had these long stretches when they aren't. But I'll tell you, if they could manage, because they're kind of, as the wild card, you know, the race for the last wild card spot goes, they're sort of not, they're not out of it and not in it either, you know, which is a weird place to be. But they do have a chance. They're going to have to go out to Los Angeles and get two out of three. And then if you back up a week and say, well, they got the Yankees and the Dodgers, and if they go 3-3 and split, they kept themselves alive, that's probably about the right way to look at it.
They're chasing the Mets and the Braves, and both of those teams are good.
Yeah, both of those teams are pretty good. So they would have to go get really, really hot and kick it in the rest of the way. And that would be a very fine time for a winning streak. But, I don't think they're going to get there. But that's what I said, not quite in it, not quite out of it.
I don't know what you do about the team in terms of, if I'm the general manager, you have a lot of people that somehow are, it's not like since the catcher position and since Pete Crow Armstrong have started hitting, they just need, they were short 20 hits a week, now they're short 8. But they just have all these guys that are pretty good players and great defensively. They're all hitting 250 when they need to be hitting 275. I mean, it's this every, and whenever they go against a team with good pitching, instead of this 18-run game where they chop up on the relievers at some team, they can't score at all. I mean, it's every hit's a two-out hit. And then they got caught stealing twice on Saturday. And if Armstrong doesn't get caught stealing, Wisdom hits a triple right behind him, of course, with two outs, then he doesn't score. I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, you got to let Armstrong run.
And the reason that they run so much is because Council has never been a manager who tries to steal a lot of bases, but they don't get any extra base hits or to speak of. I mean, they don't get enough extra base hits, and as a result, it's painstaking to score runs. So they try to steal guys into scoring position and shave one hit off of every rally if they can. It's a tough position to be in. I think it really is. If I were looking at that team, I'd say they need more extra base hits. You see the difference when Swanson has started hitting lately. All of a sudden, he is hitting a lot of doubles and some home runs. I mean, you just can't single your way through into rallies, because it's three hits to score, you know, and anything, if you want anything more than a run in an inning. Now you're starting to look at 5-6 hits necessary. Sometimes some of the guys.
Well, they won't.
Sometimes you got to hit it out of the park, but more importantly, you got to have guys that hit it into the gaps and down the lines too.
Well, you need somewhere along the line, you need some movement of people over, or you need somebody hit behind somebody, that kind of stuff. Hey, we got to go to break. When we come back, we'll have John, but I want to talk a little bit, not because they lost. I was texting with a few people about how much. We're talking about the Notre Dame game on Saturday, and I don't want to bore everybody with Notre Dame stuff, but they actually were a 28-point favorite and lost, and the way the game was managed by the head coach is a little weird. And I just want to lob a couple things out there, Kevin. I wonder if all these kids getting paid by people, by essentially boosters, is influencing some of the coaches' decision-making. I mean, it sure seems to me like it is. SP Futures up 39, NASDAQ Futures up 158. Be right back, Stocks and Jocks. Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients, and you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some may be embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howe, Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures up 38. NASDAQ Futures up 151. The world looks a hell of a lot better than it did on Friday. It's an ugly review. On Friday, Dow was down 410. S&P's down 95. NASDAQ down 437. So every time somebody tried to buy the dip, Greg, they got met with a fist in the nose pretty much. No, Friday was not good. Today over in Europe, we've got the DAX up 123.7%. FTSE up 54.7%. CAC around up 56.7%. So rallies across the board there. We're in Asia. We have Nikkei was, I think it was down even more, but got it down 175.5%. These guys are catching up for Friday a little bit. But get a load of this. Hang Seng down 247, 1.4%. 17,196, as low as we've seen it in like a real long time. Shanghai down 29, 27, 36. China consumer inflation comes in weaker than in forecast. I don't know how you believe a number over there, but even with that, the markets were down. Bonds, we are down up 4 basis points. Sorry, up 3.75. The Bund up 4 basis points, 2.21. Japan up 4 basis points, 0.89. And oil is up 62 cents, but 68.29. I mean, who'd have thunk it? All these people are telling everybody, you know, buy oil, it's going to 100, which sure as hell isn't yet. Brent up 58 cents. 71.64. Natural gas down 8 cents, 2.19. Arbob up 3 cents, 1.92. Still under 2 bucks. Greg, where'd that tap out at? 2.32? Like Memorial Day or something? Arbob? Anyway, gold up $1.40, 25.26. Silver up 31 cents, 28.49. Long way from 30 where it was a couple weeks ago. Copper up 7 cents, 4.14. We have euro is about the same. Actually, it's the euro's down a little bit. Boy, I'm sorry, my voice here. The British pound 131, so the dollar's been a little stronger, and Bitcoin, which has been down, is up 864 today, 55,240. Greg, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports, Dub Bears.
Good morning, everyone. It is 6:37 here in Chicago. We have 55 degrees right now. It's 81 today, with warm, with hazy sunshine and smoke from wildfires. Enhancing the sunrise and sunset. Phoenix 87 right now, high of 111 today. We got dehydration and heat stroke warnings for Phoenix.
It's like 110 days in a row.
Yeah, it's they've got the big red writing on here. So be careful in Phoenix. Traffic, inbound Kennedy from Montrose, 19 minutes. Eden's from Lake Cook, 45 minutes. Eisenhower from Wall, 36 minutes. Dan Ryan is 17 minutes from 95th. And Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is 31 minutes. Sports, got the White Sox win in Boston. That was 7-2. Cubs beat the Yankees at Wrigley. That was 2-1. Diamondbacks win in Houston shootout, 12-6. And NFL. The important games, Packers lose at Eagles. That was 29-34. Cardinals lose at Bills, 28-34. Mostly they lost to Josh Allen. And, of course, the Bears beat the Titans at home. That was 24-17. Caleb Williams in the spotlight. He was 14 for 29, 93 yards. He didn't throw a touchdown, but he didn't throw an interception. He fumbled once and sacked twice. You know, it could have been worse. Anyways, that's all I got.
So evidently, Kevin, we have John.
Good morning,
hey,
all.
How are you, bud? Hey, why is Justin Fields starting ahead of Russell Wilson? He started yesterday and won, right?
That was ugly,
he did.
Too.
Wilson had some kind of nagging injury.
But Fields won, right? And actually
and he played pretty well. You know, nothing spectacular, but it looks like the Steelers called twice as many runs as passes. They gave him he was like 17 out of 23, something like that. Not a lot of yards, so they probably had him throwing a lot of short passes. I think he ran for over 50 yards, which is predictable. You know, that's an example of something that the Bears didn't do with him, and it sort of leads you over to your Notre Dame question, and to an extent the Caleb Williams question yesterday too, and that is, are you running the offense that your guy can execute? And you know, if that's not going to be good enough, then you work on expanding what he can execute. But you don't just say, the Bears did 2 years in a row with Fields, as they came out at the start of the season and said, we're going to make him a drop back quarterback, a classic drop back quarterback. That's not who he is. If you want to develop that over a period of time, do it. But you know, in the meantime, do what he does well. Wouldn't you do that in any management role, where you take what your people do well and you ask them to do that, and then if you need to expand their skill set, you work on it?
Well, there's very few coaches, Kevin. I mean, the one that comes to mind is Johnny Wooden. Well, younger people probably don't remember him, but he won all these national championships, but he won with a center-dominated team, with forward-dominated teams, and guard-dominated teams. Look what he had, and that's how he designed his team.
Sure. We saw the same thing if you go back in football. We were in college during the days of Arif Parseghian. Arif Parseghian run, it was essentially the same offense. It was what he chose to execute on the offense. But he had Terry Hanratty, who was a straight drop-back quarterback and very successful with him. He had Joe Theismann, who was very mobile and could run some, but also had an NFL caliber arm, which we saw later as he went through his career. And he also he won a national championship with Tom Clements, who, you know, probably couldn't throw the ball with accuracy more than 20 yards down the field, but you know, he could throw on the move, and they had you know, a really, really good backfield that could run the ball a lot, and they won a national championship with that. That is what coaches need to be doing, is they adapt to what they have. And so many of these guys just think that their systems are so damn good that they can't flex in and out of what they do.
Well, it's got to be a lot easier for the coach to change some of the plays, or the players to change their spots.
It doesn't mean you have to scrap an offense and run something else. What it does mean is you've got a playbook with a lot of stuff in it. Use the stuff that works for the guy.
Half of Fields' completed yards only were two plays. I mean, he had maybe 150-some yards, but two of them were, I think, a 40 and a 30 to George Pickens. And
okay.
It was like, they knew what they could do and they knew what they couldn't do. And they picked their spots, which minimized his opportunity for mistakes.
Well, the Irish game, you guys were probably listening because all I heard was the complaints about the announcers. John, were you listening to this thing? And I actually was in the car, so I was listening, and the caller announcer was talking about how the other team, who I thought was amazingly well coached, the other team, he said they have basically three running plays, and they just keep running the same things and executing them. Wouldn't they go three to one side or three to the other?
Why would you change it? It was working.
And he goes, I don't know what the Irish are doing. He goes, they got all this complex blocking strategy, and they're giving the guy the ball with this big delay. He goes, sometimes on the offensive line, you pick a guy out on the other side of the line with a different colored jersey, and you hit him. He goes, sometimes it can be that simple. But my question is, now spare me with this one a little bit, but when I was a Ute, I used to love to read crazy stuff, read all the Hardy Boys stuff, and remember the Chip Hilton sports stories? I don't even forget who wrote the damn things, but anyway, he was a big star in this small high school, and then they went to college. But they were the big stars coming out of high school, and then they all went to state, just like the Dr. Pepper commercial and his dad. Anyway, they get up there, and they find out that all the other guys have a backer. So they don't want any part of these guys from this high school, even though they're all studs, especially Chip Hilton. So none of them are starting. They got no chance of getting on the team. Coach puts them in the worst light possible. They end up like on a dorm team or something his freshman year. But I wonder, Kevin, these guys were slipping in the story of the Bears, rent a quarterback year. And evidently the dude, one of his big sponsors is Dick Sports, right? This guy, what tells his last name? The quarterback from Duke? We're trying to forget the guy. But
yeah, we are trying to forget.
And evidently he brings the offensive line over there, and they got a bunch of goodies and all that stuff. And all I'm thinking, my stupid head that's all I do is think about money and taxes. I go, no, wait a minute. Are these gifts? Are these income for the offensive line? Is this guy getting the money from Dick's? And then when he parcels it out to other people, is he taking it as income and that's an expense, or is it a gift? I mean, I don't think any of these things are even defined for these goofy kids. But anyway, somebody lobbed a number out there of $1 million he's getting paid this year. I don't know if that's correct or not, but I'm sure it's something. Now, what is the freedom? Name me a coach ever in the history of football that after a kid's performance last week, and I don't have any problem with the kid. He's obviously very courageous. He runs. He's not a weenie at all. After last week's performance in the first half this week, name me a coach that doesn't change quarterbacks. If somehow he can't. Now, is it because of the money they're paying this guy? The Dicks or whoever else is giving the dough is going to have a, is going to have a hissy fit or what? I mean, the whole thing is weird.
I don't know how much that's, I don't know the degree to which that's a factor. I am sure that when they brought him in as a transfer, it was, you have first dibs on getting the job. I suppose he could have been beaten out by somebody along the way, but when you bring, first of all, if you bring in a fifth year, a graduate type of transfer, and to not play, that's probably the last one you're ever going to recruit. I don't think that's a bad thing, by the way, because I really do think you have to home grow your quarterbacks. But it doesn't mean you don't get transfers, because there are so many that have been very, very successful after transferring. What's the Bengals quarterback's name?
Oh, I don't know.
Burrow,
yeah. Burrow transferred from Ohio State to LSU. Justin Fields transferred from Georgia to Ohio State. You see lots of those examples where guys make a move, but they usually make it early in their career, and then will have 2-3 years of success at their new place. This one-year rental makes no sense to me anyway. And frankly, I don't know why getting Riley Leonard was a big upgrade over Steve Angeli, who played very, very well in their bowl game last year. And I think, C.J. Carr is more talented than either of them, but he's a freshman. Okay, so, given that, I'm sure Leonard, the job was his to lose all along. Now, I don't know what the decision-making process is. I do know that I talked to a local guy who covers Notre Dame sports and has been doing that. His name's Tim Priester, and he's been doing that for, God, I don't know, 30 years or more. And Tim was of a mind that Leonard was the perfect fit for this offense and for this team. Now, that was preseason. So, you know, somebody out there had that feeling. I know he's been to some practices, but not a lot. So he must be talking to coaches, and the coaches really had a strong feeling that this was a good fit. At what point do you scrap that if you really believed it? I don't know. You don't want to pull the trigger too soon. You don't want to pull the trigger too late. But I'm sure all of that is a factor in there. But no coach, I don't think there's any coaches out there that are foolish enough to say, well, I'm just not going to make a change. I don't care what it is, because their job, you know, can be undermined by failures. So they're, you know, how long are they going to stick with them? I don't know, but I don't think Marcus Freeman wants to be sitting on a hot seat going into next year because he lost four games this year.
Well, I mean, remember Kevin and I played on a pretty good softball team. And one of the guys on our team, when we're still alive, Jeff Beiler, was actually signed by the Yankees during the softball season. So, like, they're one of our star right fielder. And we didn't even get a chance to outbid him, Kevin. But so he goes to some A low A thing, and he was telling me, of course, he's kind of a whack job to start with, but still, he was telling me that it all depends on how much you got to play by how much you signed for and who the scout was. And he didn't sign for squat. He was there like 9 weeks. He got one start, pitched seven innings, gave up one run, and they cut him the next day. He goes, the rest of the guys, he goes, maybe a Stan Musial or a Roy Hobbs in the natural can impress so many people at the batting cage that they're gonna give you a second look. But he says, if you didn't get signed by a lot of dough or high draft pick, you're just the other eight guys to play with the one guy they want to see play. And you wonder if all along the line at every level of sports that, I mean, like last year, Hartman, Under Armour, who's a big sponsor in Notre Dame, signed Hartman to a big sponsorship. And I'm going to say Kevin somehow steered him to Notre Dame. And they thought they wanted him. And he wasn't bad. He gets there. What if our buddy John Flanagan shows up at practice and he's better? I say he's got a snowball's chance in hell that year of getting ahead of that guy unless he's Roger Staubach. I think that it really clouds the whole thing.
I'm sure it does. I'm sure everybody is looking at the investment that they have in the player. Is there co-investment because Under Armour is a Notre Dame sponsor? I don't know. But, you know, John would tell you what happens in a law firm. What's going to happen in a law firm when they bring in the hot shot from the big school, but you have, you know, you got your John Marshall lawyers who are doing a really, really nice job. Does that last forever, or is that just the guy comes in as the apple of everybody's eye, but once you're on board, you have to prove yourself. And I think that's what comes into play, is you're going to get the first look, but the first look shouldn't last forever.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, there is.
Go ahead, John.
Something seemed off to me Saturday night, and I was interested to hear you go in that direction because I couldn't put my finger on what wasn't working compared to, you know, the first game. And, you know, the point about bringing somebody in who's got, you know, a big investment behind them and big expectations, and there's a lot riding on how soon those expectations are fulfilled or they're frustrated or people start to second guess, you know, that expenditure. Maybe they shouldn't have gone in so heavy or stayed with that person so long. But this definitely, I think, has an effect on, as you said, Tom, the management of the game. And, you know, you figure how the coaches are intertwined in this, and, you know, they're implicated, I think, in a lot of the choices that are made, but they're also kind of handed situations where they've got outside money coming in that the coaches have to do the best they can with, or, you know, they're in everybody's sights. And it's not necessarily because of anything wrong with them or their ability, but they've got other people pushing you know, with some agenda or some priority for some player or some sponsor or whatever. And I can't really fathom now what is going on in a lot of these coaches' minds as they make snap decisions and are thinking about this all the time, pretty much. And, you know, well into the summer, whether they're going to have a job or not next season. So this really complicates things quite a bit.
I think it would take a real ballsy coach to have somebody, him or somebody, get, you know, whatever, somebody in for $1 million to play his senior year and be your starting quarterback, and after three practices said the guy's not good enough, we got another guy better. I think that would be like a fart church.
Well, you know what it takes? It doesn't take Marcus Freeman 3 years into his first head coaching job. It takes Kirby Smart at Georgia saying that, because he's entrenched, he's won national championships, and he's going to look at it and go, what are you going to do, fire me?
Yeah. And say, you know, say we, this other kid, we didn't think he was this good, and all of a sudden he is, or whatever. I mean,
same thing in the NFL. You know, it's first round draft picks. You know, you're gonna give them the full shot because there's a big investment in
Kirby Smart also makes $10 million a year. So, yeah, that's a pretty good one.
Well, yeah,
it's on the board. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you just wonder how all this stuff is starting to intertwine, because whenever you open up a gate, like we did to this NIL. There's pressures that you never felt before, right?
Right.
There have to be someplace, and you know, you wonder what they are. And I don't know what's the connection, you know, allegedly Under Armour and the Irish don't talk, right? Give me a break. I mean, what do you mean they don't talk? You know, how's this stuff even being orchestrated? But you also wonder how coachable are these kids when they got, how much time are they spending on football and how much time are they spending on their other stuff? I mean, didn't we start this whole thing by saying anybody going through a school like Notre Dame, or if you have a real major at Georgia, I'll bet it's a tough major. I mean, Georgia isn't a schlump old school. And what is the time division of these people now that they're supposed to be going to class? Now, the graduate students, they even go to class, Kevin? Or does anybody care?
Does anybody know what time it is?
Yeah. Anyway,
aren't you going to launch me into a lyric here?
Well, I mean, but you know, the weird part of it is Northern Illinois team. And by the way, I love their coach. And here's a guy that is not very photogenic. He's a big, heavy guy. I thought he did an unbelievable job. And you know, it wasn't anybody who sees that the Irish lost this game. As the color man said for the Irish, make no mistake about it. We got beat on offense. We got beat on defense. And we got beat on special teams. He goes, this is not like two interception run backs that could never happen again. We played again, we get the same result. The way it went
by
today.
By the way, that guy was Ryan Harris, who was like a 9-year pro who played at Notre Dame, was a first round draft pick, and all of that kind of stuff. What's interesting is his observation about how simple Northern Illinois' run offense was. As you told me, it was like three running plays that you could run either side. That was Lou Holtz. Lou Holtz, you know, he just wanted to have a few plays that they ran perfectly, and then he'd move the other teams around with formations instead. You'd still run the same plays. He'd just, you know, if they're stacking the box, good. Let's split all our receivers out. If you don't want to cover them, fine. We'll just stand up and throw the ball to them. But if you do want to cover them, then we'll spread you back out, and then we'll run our three plays.
Well, I don't get the idea.
I think that's so good for college level sports, because you know we saw Mike Denbrock's offense, which is essentially I hate to say it, but it's Brian Kelly's offense, because they've worked together for so long. So that's why you kept seeing them. You know, you get second and one, and you've got these home run hitters in the backfield. These guys that can shake free in any minute, and they're the best athletes on the offense. And instead of giving them the ball when the other team is stacked up to try and stop you on short yardage, which is when you can really pop into the open, and instead of giving them the ball and worst case moving the pile forward a yard, he's going to drop back and throw. That, God, I hate that kind of play calling.
Well, we also, the idea of running a run offense in the shotgun to me is not much good anyway. Anyway, Kevin, we're going to let you go. We're going to talk to Jan. We got stuff to talk about. talk about the market and the world in general. Thank you for doing this. So what after your first week, after the few games we saw, what teams do you like? I mean, I think Detroit's pretty solid.
Yeah, Detroit looked good. There were a few that looked good. There were a few that were pretty shaky. There were a few that were god-awful, too. I mean, Cleveland was,
Well, I wouldn't
I don't know. I don't put much on the first week. I want to see
Panthers
them play a little
look
bit
terrible.
Harder.
Yeah, Greg's saying the Panthers look terrible. I think the Packers look pretty good. The Eagles are just good. I mean, the Packers didn't embarrass themselves. They lost by a little.
Yeah, I hate to say anything nice about the Packers.
Oh, God. Their quarterback, I think, is going to be pretty decent. What do you think? That Love guy?
Well, he's not going to be decent for at least a few weeks because he got hurt.
Sprained MCL.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do they have a backup that's any good?
Nope.
Not really.
Their backup is somebody they picked up a couple of weeks ago.
Is his name Flanagan?
Yeah, John's the backup quarterback.
I can see John overworking all these deals. You get $1 million, you get $2 million. Why aren't you an agent for these guys, Jen? They allegedly don't have agents. What do they call them? They're marketing guys or something, Jen? Or Kevin?
And of ours.
We'll hook them up with Lou.
What's the word they call it in Mexico when you got to pay some guy all the time to? That's a great if you ever do business in Mexico. If you introduce to somebody at a bar, if I introduce Jen to Kevin. Then any business John does with Kevin for the rest of his life, I'm supposed to get a piece. There's a name for it. I'll think of it. Anyway, Kevin, thank you very much. John, talk about switching gears. Audrey and I went to. Did you ever go to Big Lots?
Once.
Big Lots, the store.
Yeah, once I was there.
And they're closing a whole bunch of stores.
Yeah.
So we go to one that's closing yesterday in Lockport. And, you know, all the people that work there, I mean, Audrey knows them all, I don't. They're so nice, and the people who used to go there a lot were people, you know, don't have a lot, right? So they're on first-name basis with half the customers. And they're, you know, of course, they're venting to Audrey, because Audrey, you know, talks to everybody, she's like me. And they're saying they've had something like 4 CEOs in 3 years, and every one of them got a bunch of dough to show up, and every one of them screwed the place up more than they did before. And she goes, we used to have, you know, stuff they buy on clearance from manufacturers and things like that. It actually was a lot cheaper than somewhere else, but it was good stuff. Then all of a sudden they started kind of cheating and they were charging almost as much as the regular places, even though they were getting it on runoff prices and stuff. And so they started to lose some business doing that because the stuff wasn't as big of a bargain. And all of a sudden, they're closing all these different stores. They're selling fixtures. They're selling everything. And, Jen, it's just so sad. You see the people that are all going to get laid off, and you see the, and yet I'm taking on what the lady said about the CEOs, but I bet they're all doing fine. And yet, she says all they did was screw the place up. What, you know, it's like a quarterback that can't throw.
Well, there's horror stories about, you know, places like Dollar General, you know, where they have a very defined target audience, and the stuff that's come out about how Dollar General, you know, had all of these deceptive pricing habits, you know, with putting one thing on the sticker where the thing was on the shelf, and then inflating it at the, you know, cashier, and it would never be such a huge amount that a lot of people noticed it or took the time to unravel it after they got home to figure out, wait a minute, I thought it was this price. But it was rampant, and it was, you know, from the top down to do this. And, you know, there's a couple consumer actions, I think, against it. But, you know, by and large, people didn't have any other options for shopping. It isn't like they could, you know, go across the street to something else and get anything close to that price, or, you know, maybe drive 20 miles. Who's going to do that for a little bit of money? So they had a captive audience, and now you've got, you know, this has got all sorts of implications for people's, you know, survival as consumers, because all of these low-end places, you know, that were attractive because they had low prices, whether it was fast food places or Big Lots or Dollar Tree or Family Dollar, any of these places have realize now that they're up against a consumer that can't even afford their prices, no matter how they slash them. And it's going to accentuate how badly managed things are, that they haven't foreseen this, and that people are going to lose their jobs, they're going to lose their shopping options and everything else in process. And it seems a damn shame, but it didn't have to happen, I don't think. It didn't have to happen all at once, certainly. But now it's going to, the consumer is the one who's going to be most hurt. But then think of the employees who are going to be out of a job, too, because of this.
Oh, yeah. It's crazy as it may seem. There was a person in Cleveland. He had a little brokerage firm, and we were trying to recruit him. And I think he had diabetes real bad, and he had some health issues. But one of the nicest guys I ever met. A real smart guy. And we actually did the bike trail. There's a canal from Cleveland to Akron, because in Ohio, the topography is different than here. Lake Erie is a lot lower than Lake Michigan. So actually, you got to get up and over to get to the Ohio River from Lake Erie. It's not straight down like here from Chicago to Mississippi. There's no up and over. The canal was just connected to it. Anyway, so we have lunch with this guy, African-American dude. He used to supply these dollar stores. Boy, talk about a smart dude. And he was connected all over the place business-wise. And I said to him, how the hell do you sell something to a place where they're charging a buck and you make any money? And I think he did soap or something, a bunch of different kinds of soap. And he goes, you got to be good at it. And he says, we get the, tell me, John, I get the cap from Mexico, and that's 3 cents. I get the bottle from Canada, and that's 5 cents. Because for them to buy it from you and sell it at a buck, I think they only want to pay 50 cents, maybe 55. If something's really valuable, maybe 60, but they wanted a double. So he goes, yeah, I get that. The cap was 3 cents. The bottle, the plastic bottle, was 5 cents. And the stuff that went in it was like, I don't know, 8 cents or something. So he goes, I'm up to like 14, and I sell it to him at 50, and he sells it for a buck. And I'm going, he goes, we're all happy. And I'm going, wow. He goes, yeah. I said, how the hell do you get, what about the shipment? I mean, you've got the cap and the bottle come from two different countries. He goes, it's no problem. They ship it up here, and you get a big enough box. There's a zillion caps in there, and away you go. And he must have had 30 or 40 different products he sold at these places. And he was all over it. And he said, yeah. He goes, the stuff that goes in the bottle is really good. It's just a smaller amount. He goes, not everybody needs to buy a gallon of something, or a cleaning solution or whatever. And he goes, that's why those places exist. And he goes, we're doing real well. And so are they. And so are the consumers. I'm going, really? I mean, there is an art to it, but you can imagine, how do you get something to somebody for 50 cents?
Well, the Walmart, model for this was, we're going to sell microwave ovens in our stores. And here's what we're going to sell them for. And we're going to find the producer that's going to, produce them for this price. It's going to be, pushing sort of the volume upstream back to the manufacturer to make them comply with what the vendor has decided is going to be the going rate for this. So that's tremendous power when you can do that, because you effectively control, the manufacturing end of it as well, because that's going to now be, not too many manufacturers can afford to just snub one vendor to sell them a big portion of their products and try to cultivate it with another one. And I think the dollar stores are an interesting example of how you can cut this to the bare bones, pretty much, for little household items, toothpaste or canned goods or, kitchen utensils, whatever kind of stuff, and get it to rock bottom and have, a good supply chain in place with a price that's relatively stable and affordable. And the only thing that's going to mess that up is if it's no longer affordable. If you've got the people at the consuming end see this price isn't as attractive as it once was, and it's not attractive at all now. So that whole thing is going to dry up. What do you do then for going back upstream to push the price, of manufacturing it down even further? I don't know. This is a race to the bottom in some ways, but the consumers, I think, now have the upper hand, I guess is one way to put it, although
I'm not so sure they do.
That's a misleading statement. I don't mean that they have much power at all. But if they don't shop, they've got tremendous power, whether they know how to wield it or if it translates to something else that benefits them. It's clearly happening now where these stores are facing a dried up customer base, and I don't think they've figured out how to cope with that. I don't think they know the way out of it.
Well, I think you see, and I don't know how this all works, but it seems crummy to me. How's that for a term? Because I shop at Meijer's a lot. It's right near Audrey's and blah, blah, blah. And I get cheap gas and good coffee for $1.80 for extra large instead of 3-something at Dunkin' Donuts. So I go there, and I get to the point where I know half the people. But you go in the aisles, Jan. If you're been around as long as you and I have, you notice the selection continues to get less and less.
Yeah.
I mean, there's maybe instead of 8 brands of toothpaste, there's 2 or 3, and then for every brand, there's the Meijer's offshoot. So I think it not only is that you're driving or the mouthwash. Okay, you'll see the 8 different kinds of Listerine. And they got maybe 2 or 3 brands there. Well, they get some of the special brands too, but you'll see the Meijer's brand. So I think it even goes down to they're demanding. Actually, the consumer has less choice. So even if you wanted to pay up, say, for Noxzema's shave cream, you're not going to get it. Because obviously Noxzema's not playing ball with Meijer's or Walmart. Now, but they're also forcing these places to sell their stuff to them so they can put it on their private label. So I think one of the ways that Listerine gets in the store, even though it's a big brand, is they're selling Meijer's their Listerine and at a cheaper price, and Meijer's essentially competing with the Listerine, which is really messed up. Because if you look at all the different, this is not what I do for a living, but if you look at all the different mouthwashes, if you go up the chain to the top shelf Listerine, this will say only available by Listerine. You ever seen that? No.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I was saying, the ones on the bottom shelf, the gold stuff or the yellow stuff, the original, the stuff in the Listerine bottle is the same as the stuff in the Meijer's bottle. But as you work your way up the shelves, Listerine's new products, the ones with like no alcohol and stuff, they're not giving those to anybody yet. And it says so right on there. I mean, this retailing is fascinating, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you can see this in pharmaceuticals and Walgreens. As, they've got all their own knockoff versions of stuff, pretty much. All the, the food stores. I mean, there's stuff you can tell by the packaging is manufactured by some, well-known place, but it's now being marketed to Aldi for sale, and it's got related labeling, the packaging and stuff. So it isn't like they just ripped it off. They've got permission to do that, but it's not quite the same grade, or it's a slightly cheaper version of it. But it gives the consumer the impression that you've got some kind of choice here, which is fine as long as there is a choice. But as you say, there's fewer and fewer choices now, even at Aldi. So,
well, what does the when you talk about, if you had the people that wrote the Sherman Act, the Clayton Act, and the Robinson-Patman Act, if you put them in a room and the guy says, "Okay, here's the deal: if you want to sell mouthwash in our place or toothpaste, not only do you got to meet this price, you got to sell us the stuff at like half the price so we can undercut you on the same shelf." Can you imagine that conversation with a real antitrust attorney sitting there?
Yeah, blank stares.
Yeah, like what are we doing here? God, all right, shifting gears, the market had a horrible week last week, John. This week, today we're up 20.32 in the SPOOs, 124. We're up about a third of the way, maybe, in the NASDAQ, a little more than a third of the way in the S&Ps. What do you think's going on? We've got the debate tomorrow night. We politically, every day it seems, more and more people are kind of coming out and saying, I mean, these are people in Washington that people have respected for a while that, I mean, what's her name? Who ran against Trump to the last night? Nikki Haley?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she came out last night and said, look, she's endorsing Trump, and she goes, at this point, these are the people we have to work with. We got to pick one. I'm thinking, there's an endorsement. And she says, she thinks Trump is going to do a better job. And obviously that's her opinion, and he might, actually. I don't know. But I mean, that's... When's the last time we voted for somebody, Jen? I think the last time I voted for somebody, I might have... the first Obama, I might have voted for him. Not the second time I didn't vote for him. And I think I voted for Jerry Ford. I liked him. Other than that, I can't think of somebody I really liked.
Well, I've never been enthralled with anybody I've ever voted for any slot. Like, when I look back on it, I mean, I had greater hopes, and maybe some of these hopes were fulfilled more in some cases than others, but I've never been satisfied. And this is something you can't expect in a government system like this, where, you know, majority rules in elections, and you are always forced to make choices that are hardly your first choice. And sometimes maybe your fifth, sixth, or tenth choice by the time you get through with it. That's always been the game. I don't think it's any different now, except that you've got so much money pouring in to back certain, you know, viewpoints or certain candidates, that there's distortions in the kind of choices you get that you didn't always have. And there was a better winnowing out process, I think, at conventions, to, you know, with multiple ballots and, you know, jockeying and, you know, giving up stuff or making promises to get what you wanted in order to get slated, you know, to get the slot on the ticket. In the long run, that probably was a fairer process than what we have now, which is, you know, sort of a joke. I think that part of it is a joke anyway.
But they throw, you know, a whole bunch of money at somebody, and you have these two early primaries, and if everybody else is just supposed to quit, even though one zillionth of the people have been heard from in the country.
Right. And, you know, but before we're through, I have a hunch that you're going to see, you know, the current presidents step aside to resign, and, you know, we'll have, you know, the current vice president become the president. We'll be running as an incumbent by the time election day comes around, and there'll be pardons galore. You know, the whole process is going to start to happen pretty fast after that. But, you know, that's what's lurking behind a lot of people's thoughts about what am I voting for? You put early voting into the mix, and imagine, you know what's going to happen to the people's impressions of where the race is headed if it's a completely different set of candidates by the time they go into the polling place.
What is the impetus? And, you know, Greg's a younger dude. What is the impetus with this early voting? Am I just a mature male?
It's BS, Tom. And, you know, I've made my complaints to the Chicago Board of Election Commissioners about what I've seen happen even on election day, let alone early voting. But the idea of putting all of the resources into having polling places open 7 days a week for weeks before the election, what does that cost, and what does that take away from monitoring the elections when you actually go to count the ballots?
Why can't we, as much as the people on the right rag about the people on the left, you know, getting the wrong people to vote and blah, blah, blah. The simple fact is both sides will do whatever they can to not allow the people to vote that they think are going to vote against them, right? If we wanted to be fair, I think we would use the European model and maybe say you vote on a Saturday and a Sunday because of religious differences. You probably need both of those days. And, oh, by the way, if you need an absentee ballot, you better be in the Army or you better be on vacation or something. I mean, there should be very few of those, because I think going down to the polling place and having somebody looking at you and you know, checking your signature and whatever they do, and actually you showing up, I don't think you really have to. I better show an ID card a couple of times because I changed my signature from Thomas to Tom, but I didn't have a problem with that. I say change, I got lazy. Is that the right way to put it? Instead of writing Thomas, I write Tom. But I mean, I don't have a problem with that. To me, it sort of makes sense. Now, if you can't get there, well, obviously that's different. Or, you know, but it's, to me, if you're going to do the idea with the mail stuff, and I understand where, you know, the people on the right are upset, because I think most people should be, okay, the mail ballot comes in. Well, where's the signature? Well, the signature's on the envelope. Okay, but we don't want to match the two together, so we throw the envelope out. So when we do a recount, we can't match up the people with the ballots at all, or even the amount of people. Where in my precinct, if, you know, 100 people show up, you should have 100 ballots, right? But somewhere else, well, we got 500 ballots. Where's the envelopes? Where does it say that we should only have 400 ballots? Well, we threw all those out. I mean, the protocol, Jan, seems to be, and this is somebody from the middle, the protocol seems a little weird to me. The idea that states run national elections on their own. I mean, this has become a national election. I mean, really? So every state's got their different rules and can squirrel stuff away? That doesn't make sense to me. A lot of stuff doesn't make sense to me, but I mean, what are we doing here? And now we've got two people running. One, the hope is, if she wins, she's young enough she can grow into the office, and if she gets the right people around her, might surprise to the upside. I mean, one thing I'll say about Trump, he's not going to learn anything new. I mean, he stopped learning when he was 25, in my opinion, but maybe not. Kevin thinks he's a...
Well, I think he's a lot smarter now than he was in 2016.
I'm saying that there, you would hope so. If it was you or me, the answer would be you certainly. Because look what you went through, you never dreamed you were going to go through. But, you know, can he shake the rest of his personality enough to let that through? The hope is yes. If he gets in, the hope is yes. If she gets in, the hope is that she grows along the way, puts right people around her, and is 10 times smarter 2 years from now than she is now.
That would be the hope, Tom. But, of course, my expectation is that she will be covered for by the press just the way they covered for Biden all 4 years.
That
doesn't necessarily have anything
there's no way. There's no way the press can cover the fiscal problems we have, the international problems we have, the issue with the people in this country not feeling like it. I didn't get a chance to talk to you last week because you weren't on Monday. Did you see the difference in the interviews between who the hell was the person? Oh, I was listening to a person on CNBC after the shootings in Forest Park. They interviewed this gentleman, obviously African American. You can tell. I'm thinking 99% chance. You can tell by somewhat of the accent. I don't think that's being politically incorrect. And he said, and he was an older guy. He goes, I've never seen a world like this. All we're doing is fighting politically. He goes, I see people out of work. I see people not going to school. I see kids not being taught. And people are mad at everybody. He goes, this world is screwed up. We're gonna have to get this back together pretty quick. And then the next day, I'm listening to this buffoon on CNBC basically saying that the economy is spectacular despite some of the knocks it's taken. People who don't believe that are just flat out wrong. Nothing is wrong. This is all going the right way. You got to invest. You got to do that. I'm trying. Could these two people be looking at the same world? I think there are a real lot of problems. And whoever the president is, we've let the charade go. The next 4 years are going to be key for somebody. Now, if Trump learned enough in 2016 and has the street smarts that I think he probably has, can he do something to forget all the crap that people have done to him and whatever and where they should have done it? If he can forget all that and just be president and use his experience for 4 years and try and get the bus back together, I'm all for him. I don't know that he can do that. Can she grow up and be 10 times better than she is right now because that's what that job is demanding? Or is she going to turn into Barack Obama and just let other people run the thing and be the voice? I don't think the press is going to let us get away with being broke forever. I don't think the press can possibly let us get away with bad international decisions. I mean, whatever the next president is, the bleep is going to hit the road, I think. And I don't. There's no way around it. You're not going to glad hand your way around the next 4 years, I don't believe. I think it's a very key presidency. So there, I ran it too much.
Well, I agree completely, but I look around, at the other signs of unrest throughout the world. And look at Brazil, for example. There's now a Twitter ban, which is a huge slap to businesses, to the people of Brazil. But
X ban. What's Twitter? X
ban. Yes. Thank you. But it's all to save the image of Lula, the sitting president. It isn't about striking a blow for anything else other than saving his posterior and getting rid of his opposition. I mean, this is the way social media has been twisted and tortured into partisan results, to get the political advantage you want over some perceived opponent, or righteousness versus degradation, or democracy versus fascism. I mean, it's all these crazy terms that are being bandied around in this country too. But the prospects look pretty bad if you look elsewhere around the world. There's a lot of countries that are farther down the tube than we are when it comes to you know, freedom of expression.
What do you mean? We're the only hope. Did you see that? Did I ship that thing to you? An article. Did somebody ship it to me? It had to do with they had the entire world on there. You know, a map. Something like was it 50% or 60% or 70%, Jan, of the world has governments that are so screwed up, and then there was the economic page right next to it.
We're in that too, Tom.
No, we're not even close.
Oh, God, I mean, look at the Justice Department that's got being the enemies. And, you know, of course, we're in the same boat, exactly.
Well, we're not.
It's just that it hasn't played out in as draconian a fashion yet, but it certainly is happening that way in the UK.
Well, you and I will disagree on a lot of stuff. I think we both agree that the government could be doing one hell of a lot better, and has to be going forward, because I think they're going as far as they can without doing anything. I mean, certainly in Chicago, at some point, there needs to be a revolution of sorts to say, let's get somebody in here that's competent, for God's sake. And but having said, I'm talking about Venezuela, Brazil. How many people live there, in these places? We're talking about every. I mean, the map was every place in Africa, pretty much, except for maybe Egypt and a couple others. Every place. I mean, the government's so bad you can't live there. I mean, they had Russia there. I mean, look what this guy's done. Has anybody eaten over there? Look how many people he's killed. I mean. We're not like that, thank God. You're right, we're trending the wrong direction. You get no argument.
Yeah, we're farther along than anybody will tell you, Tom, or admit to, either. So that you've got elections now so stifled where you can't get, a fair shot in Chicago, I don't think, to get on the ballot. It's been that way for a while, but it's got real repercussions now, given the shallow talent pool you're seeing. You got one party government, pretty much, if you listen to national media.
Well, or no party government. There's no party. Everybody runs individually.
No, I would disagree. I mean, I think that there's the people for democracy and there's the people against democracy, if you listen to mainstream media. And how ridiculous is that?
Well, everybody's defining democracy their own way these days.
Well, yeah, the ones saying our democracy is threatened, but the ones who have done the best job of putting it under their heels, so
yeah,
I don't listen to those.
Well, I mean, we have is incalculable concentration of wealth and political power in a few people. It's probably worse than we probably could pick a few times when it was almost as bad, but it's pretty bad. I mean, in the 20s, it was probably as bad, maybe a little worse. And look what happened there. I mean, this cannot, from an economic standpoint, John. It's not the people. We just can't be like this. I mean, today I was the Boeing people. Now I should know the history of their contracts, but they've been out without a contract for a while, right?
Yeah.
So I think the contract, new one, is a 25% raise over, was it 5 years? And it just happened like this morning or last night. So I don't know what they've gotten in terms of a raise for the last 5 years. Do you? I mean, we'd have to do some. Lou will probably know, but if it turns out over the COVID to today number is 25 or 30% total, sorry, that sucks. Right.
Right.
And it sounds like a hell of a lot, and a lot of people aren't getting anywhere near that. But I mean, I'm going to say since February of 2020 till today, inflation numbers are somewhere between 35 and 45.
Easy.
And I don't see how a 25% raise, although it sounds an awful lot. And what if you were, I think Boeing guys are making more than this. What if you were making 40 grand and now you're making, let's say, what would 25% of that? It'd be 50 grand. Well, now you're paying 22% of taxes on the next 10 instead of 12. So the government gets their chunk of this. Do you think either one, Trump maybe, I don't know, do you think either one of these people have any idea that the biggest beneficiary of inflation is the government?
Oh, sure.
You think that?
I think any politician with half a brain should know that, but it's easy to overlook it. But there's not enough money in anybody's dream budget, Tom, to pay for the salaries that need. People need to be earning in order to be able to afford to live. When you've got such profligate spending on stuff that nobody needs, and in fact is counterproductive, but nobody wants to take the time to winnow it out and get rid of it.
What kind of spending are you talking about? You're talking about government spending.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the trick
including,
is...
Including a lot of government salaries that are completely unnecessary. Job positions that are unnecessary. But nobody's going to take the political hit for slashing and burning what needs to be slashed and burned at some point. And I just don't... I see us limping along and printing more and more money to pay people more and more so they can afford, you know, household... you know, necessities that nobody really has figured out how in the long run are ever going to be paid for, and everybody's going to continue to go into hock to try to stay ahead of this game. And the really tough work of saying, wait a minute, we can't afford to fight this war. We can't afford to fund this war behind the scenes. We can't afford to do a lot of the things we've gotten used to doing. So guess what? As of this moment, your plug is pulled. I just don't think people are prepared for the kind of concussion that will send out. But somebody will have to do it at some point, and it won't be easy.
Well, maybe the market may just do it itself. I mean, the market may just do it itself. Or when I say the market,
it will take a lot of people with it. You know, and it will be a real jolt, such that we don't have any experience with, and that's the reason nobody wants to do it. But it's we're not the only one in this basket at the moment, certainly.
Well, it seems like Europe and Australia have righted the ship a little better than we have, at least Britain.
Well, I think Argentina's done a better job than we have. Let's say something.
Now, what would you do in a few minutes here? And the inflation part, I mean, Carl and I go back and forth on this all the time. I mean, I think everybody on the show has agreed what has happened. And one of the biggest problems I have with Trump is blaming. From a political side, I understand why he's doing it, but got from a truth side, which he didn't seem to care about, all the inflation is Biden's. To be honest with you, at least 80% of it is Trump's, or his reaction to the COVID or whatever. But it's a combined effort between the two of them, let's put it that way. The solution to the price bubble that 80% of Americans can't deal with is to essentially drag some of that money back out of the system. I think if you did it in a gradual way, you might have a chance at not upsetting the whole world. The market will go down a little bit probably, but maybe not that much. And Carl's convinced that the only way to get it back on track is in the next year to yank 20% of the money supply out of the place. By the way, it's going up right now, but which it shouldn't be, but it is. And I don't. Other than that, I mean, I'm not so sure I could even recommend that, John. Even though that's sort of what economically has to happen. Now, are we going to let some untoward stuff like the crash of 29 happen and let it all happen when we don't control it, or we try and control it, or what? I don't know what I'd even recommend in a room of people if I was making a recommendation. I think I would probably say let's drag out 2 or 3% this year, and do it in such a gradual way that maybe there's a chance that wages and stuff could catch up. I think we got to give ourselves that chance. My chances of success on it, I guess, hope and drink a lot, right?
Yep. Well, I hope the next time we're smarter about all this stuff, Tom, because the whole panic response to COVID, which, panicking people for no reason, and the pharmaceutical industry, probably the worst offender of all. But not just that, it was people looking to get rid of, the average small business, put restaurants out of business, put the small, operations out, let the Walmarts and the Costcos and the Home Depot stay open, but shut down everybody else. I hope the next time we realize that it's going to take some pain to undo the damage we did by that. But the first thing we have to resolve is not to fall victim to that kind of panic peddling ever again. And to mess with people's lives at such a ridiculously invasive level.
Well, Jen,
I don't know if we're that smart.
I think it comes to who do we have in office, and what experience level do they have? I mean, I've been in small businesses my whole life. Well, Pullman wasn't, but when you lose a place, when you lose a restaurant, people don't really necessarily give a crap if you're a politician. As long as the main numbers stay the same, all you do is watch CNBC or Fox all day long. As long as the GDP stays here, everybody's healthy. No, they're not. But people don't have an understanding, I think, John, of how hard it is to start something up. Like, I had a conversation with, you know, the former Mayor Daley at the club, and he says, well, how come we're not building railroad cars here anymore? And I went through my long story about, you know, Pullman and blah, blah, blah. He says, well, why can't we just, like, do it again? I go, maybe you have no idea of the history of the drawings and the machines and the people and the knowledge that it takes for some place like that to get together. It takes, I'm going to say, maybe a decade if you had to start from scratch. I don't even know who the hell you'd... There's probably still some rail car engineers around you could start with, but it's a lot. It's so much easier to destroy than to build. I mean, you know, if you had... You wanted to see what this part were. You had a blacksmith shop. You had these punch machines. You had, you know, all these. You had these old lathes. If you wanted to try something new, you could do it. You had people with the fixturing. You had the draftsmen. You had the welders. You had all that stuff. You had the ladies in the wire room. They did these huge things of wires. They just went in the car and they all fit exactly where they're supposed to fit. I said, you know how long it would take to start that? That's why you have to be careful. Even a store or a restaurant. There's somebody who runs the place, somebody who works a gazillion hours going to buy the stuff. You have people coming in there. You got cooks. You've got people who put the chairs together and everything. Okay, you're out of business for 6 months. Well, somebody else will pop in there. No, they won't.
No, that's this disposable mentality people have. Well, if it's not that thing, it'll be another thing. So who cares? You know, just pick up where you left off. No, it doesn't work that way at all.
Any more
than it does trying to create a neighborhood out of a completely vacant, multiple acres of land.
Well, you know, we come back. We'll wait till we come back, right? Because the audio will be in.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about that. How the north side, people say, why don't people do stuff on the west side or the south side? Well, we'll wait till after break. SP Futures up 33, NASDAQ Futures up 129. Hopefully, we'll have an update today. Be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com, PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howe. We have Greg Pappas on the board, pretty much where we were before. SP Futures up 32. NASDAQ Futures up 128. We started down last night a little bit, and then we've been gaining strength all night long, and we haven't given anything away here, so maybe we'll get a first update in a while. Dow futures up 224 over in Europe. The bullishness over here, they're up 76. Well, they were up more a minute ago. DAX is up 76.4%. FTSE up 53.7%. CAC around up 40.5. So strength across the board, but not crazy. Not as much as they're down on Friday. Over in Asia, though, different picture. Nikkei down 175.5%. Hang Seng down 247, ouch, 1.5%, 17,196. Shanghai down 29,2736. So whack, whack, whack on the Chinese markets for sure. On Friday, again, the bad news was 410 down on the Dow, 95 in the S&P, NASDAQ down 436. Bonds, 10-year, there was up more. Now we're only up 2 basis points, 372. Same thing with the Bund, only up 2 basis points, 2.20. They were up like 4 or 5 a little bit ago. Yen, though, Japanese, it's up 4 basis points, 0.89. Oil, we've got oil, which is way down. It's up 77 cents, but check out the whole number, 68.44. No wonder gas is going down. Brent up 71 cents, 71.77. Natural gas down 9, 218. RBOB up 3 cents, 193. Gold up 5.30 now, 25.29. Silver up 31 cents, 28.49. Boy, the last year, if I would have... What do you think, Greg? How many times could we have sold silver over 30 and bought it under 28?
Never too late.
Yeah, except the first time I do it, I'd sell it at 30, it'll be 35. You gotta be careful.
That's why we do it with options.
That's why that's why we use risk control devices. Is that what you're saying over there? Yeah. Copper up 6 cents, 4.13. FX, we've got the U.S. Dollar's been getting a little bit weaker. The Euro's down to 110, it was 111. British pound 131, it was 132. So very slight move there. Bitcoin up 778 today, but still 55,154. It was 60 a few weeks ago. Greg, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports? Not much going on. The Bears, you know, Bears win.
Bears win. That's true. Morning, everyone. 7:38 here in Chicago. It is 54 degrees, high of 81 today. We have some haze due from distant wildfires, so hazy sunset today, too. Check it out. Phoenix, 85 degrees right now, high of 109 today. Dehydration and heat stroke warnings there, so be careful if you're out in Phoenix. Traffic inbound Kennedy from Montrose is 33 minutes. Edens from Lake Cook is 74 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf, 57 minutes. Inbound Ryan from 95th is 26 minutes, and Stevenson 294 to the Ryan is 41 minutes. Sports, we got the U.S. Open. That concluded. Sabalenka wins the women's draw. Sinner wins the men's draw. Baseball, White Sox beat Boston. That was 7-2. Cubs beat the Yankees at Wrigley. That was 2-1. Diamondbacks win in Houston. That was 12-6. NFL, only games that matter. Packers lose at Eagles, 29-34. Cardinals lose at Bills. That was 28-34. Bears beat the Titans. That was here, 24-17, with Williams completing 14 of 29 passes for 93 yards. He didn't throw a touchdown, but he didn't throw an interception. So, that's all I got, Chief.
Is the U.S. Open still a multi-generational hard ticket to get?
Multi-generational?
I mean, if your family didn't have them, you don't... It's not that hard anymore.
Well... It's not easy because there's only the two big stadiums, but there's, I mean, I know people who have gone just. There was a significant amount of planning, but that was mostly on the housing side, not the ticket side.
I don't recall, John. Did you have one of the PTI, one of the Stocks and Jacks producers call you up with press passes for the U.S. Open?
No,
I did not either. Bob, did you?
I must have missed that whole memo.
Yeah. So you're saying Mr. Pappas was deficient? We didn't get our press passes at the convention, U.S. Open. How about Bear games?
Too cold, too far to walk afterwards.
Yeah, okay, there you go. Notre Dame games, I'm not so worried about going anymore after the fiasco on Saturday. Art, how are you?
I'm fine. Good morning. What a
good
beautiful
morning,
day.
Buddy.
Yeah.
Good morning, honey. How are you?
Good, thanks. And you?
I'm doing okay. It's just been such a string of beautiful weather around here that you just really have to enjoy every day you're getting like this.
Yes.
You got to enjoy it and keep watering. We haven't had any rain in forever.
Yes. But that's okay. It's nice to water a day like this. It's
yes.
Refreshing.
But what's going on in world of real estate? Seems like it's keeping churning along. I understand with the rates down a little bit, Nancy's got some business as well. So I'm going to say things are pretty good where you're coming from.
Yeah, I mean, things are fine. It's been a good season. You know, it still is, for the people who are still out there looking for a house, it's still challenging because, again, there's some more inventory coming online, but it's still the best and prettiest and most redone are the first ones snapped up and still multiple offers. I had two situations of that last week where put a multiple offer in, and again, you have a struggle to get the deal done. So that's still there, and it's still tight in certain markets. It's still going along, and if we do get another rate cut this fall, that will help. I think Nancy said her rates are around 6.25, 6.5, which is, you know, an improvement over what it was. And if we get knocked down and we end up around 6.6, and I don't know, if we get a quarter point even, that'll help. Take us down 6.125. That would be a good fall incentive, and I think you'll see more people out. More people are moving around, so there's hope for the housing market. I'm seeing a little bit of prices prices aren't going to come flying down. That's just not going to happen. But it's what you're saying is if it's not selling in the first week or so, people are much more quickly adjusting the price down a little bit in response. They're not getting showings. They're not getting an offer. I see them moving the price accordingly. So not a bad time to be out looking. Still a good time to be out selling. You're still getting great prices. If you have a place to go or you know what you're going to do afterwards, you're still going to get a great price for your house, and buyers are getting something a little more reasonable. So actually, I think it's the best situation we've seen in about a year.
What does the official real estate representative of Stacks and Jacks, Audrey Jansen, hang with her July comment that was the top?
Yes.
What do you think, John? I think she's right. I hate to say that, but I think she's right.
Yeah.
But nobody likes to compliment anybody on the show. Nobody. No, I think Audrey's absolutely right on that one.
So I'm seeing just what you're talking about in my neighborhood, Audrey.
Really?
A couple stretches of, you know, one single block I know of that in the last week, four for sale signs went up. And I would say all of these properties have had significant remodeling over the years. So they're kind of topped out now. And I think the plan always was to sell these after the remodeling was done and move on to something else, repeat the process or whatever. But these are definitely properties that will sell, I think, because they're attractive. They're redone very well. They show very well. What I don't see, though, is a lot of, you know, modest listings coming on the market, like the little bungalows, you know, $150,000, $200,000. Nothing like that at all. And I think that that's a real hole in the inventory, at least in my neighborhood.
Well, you're so right. The entrance level price has become so much higher. I would say that out in my area, a first-time buyer home, you're looking at for a tiny, small, little frame house is maybe $300. So, yeah. I mean, you probably look at it $300 to $450 for a so-called starter, which is far beyond what, you know, any of us had paid for our first home. So that's what's clogging up that market, as we talked about, is the aspirational buyers have to stay in that price range, and the first-time buyers are still fighting. They're fighting for those lower-end homes. So that's a tough thing. But I don't know. I just don't see a way around that. It's just they're gonna. What I'm seeing, and I don't know, John, if you've seen this, that the builders out here are building things that are a little smaller, so they can sell them a little cheaper. And that happened, I think, what, maybe back in the 70s, too, if I remember correctly, in response to that debacle, that it was a small home on a smaller piece of land with less square footage, so you could get started at least. Right. I think you're going to see that now.
Well, since we had the, it hasn't been that long, but since we had the 3.5% mortgage type of thing, or 3, and people got in with the idea, well, they're never going to be able to leave. For the most part, a lot of those people have made some money on that house, right? And if you have the growing family, you know, maybe you can have a second kid in the current house, but if the wife surprises you with twins or something, or you're onto your third kid, Nancy seemed to indicate there's maybe a little bit of movement where somebody's willing, especially if you're up on the price of your house, to go from the 3% to the 6 or 3.5 to the 6. I mean, obviously, she talks about people that are divorced or you die. I mean, that'll do it. But is there any movement at all in the just the regular movement where somebody says, you know what, we need the extra bedroom, we need this extra garage, let's just do it. We made enough money on this and we can suck up to 6%. Is any of that happening yet?
You know what? You see some, but not a lot, because if you're going from a 3% to a 6, okay, say you bought something for 3 and you're selling it for 5.
My friend is no different than any other powerful man.
And then you want to buy something that's probably going to be 6.50 to 7, and even you probably didn't pay your mortgage off, and say you've got that extra 2 or let's say 300 to put on it, at 6% you're still incurring a much bigger cost to carry. So I would say unless you're pushed, I see people remodeling, I see people adding on, unless, you know, you won the lotto, your parents left you a bunch of money, you cashed in some of your stock portfolio. I think people are much more cautious. It's more of a necessity, because if you've got, you know, anywhere from, you know, 3 to 5%, I don't see you move it unless you had to, or you, you know, like I said, you found the house of your dreams, you can't resist.
What, how much when you do a place, or when Nancy's doing the mortgage, it's obviously all tied together. Not that you guys are tied together, but I mean the process, somebody can pay something and they just can pay something, and you got to find a way to, between the mortgage, how much is what seems to be in some areas the incredible increase in insurance, and in some areas the taxes have gone through the roof, how much is that impacting between that and the interest rate going up? It seems like the actual nut per month has to be a lot higher than it was 3-4 years ago.
It is a lot higher. Yeah, you have to take all those factors in, and especially even if you're going. I have a first time buyer now, and she thought she wanted a condo or a townhome. Well, the cost of expenses, like running a condo or a townhome, have gone up like cost of running anything else. But a lot of the monthly maintenance fees have knocked the first time buyers out of that market almost, because maybe a maintenance fee that used to be on a two-bedroom condo, $150, $180, maybe it's another $100. So if you're paying $250 a month, that on top of your mortgage payment, on top of your insurance and taxes.
Well, the place you lived, it was in the condo place.
Yeah.
I forgot the name of it, but I mean, you still sell stuff in there, so you're pretty up on it. Now, when you left, that was what, 15 years ago or something? Maybe how long ago?
Got over 20 years ago.
So what were you paying? Just to give everybody a feel. Now that didn't have the gated thing where you had the guy at the gate 24 hours or anything like that. But you had a clubhouse and people. It was always nicely taken care of and so forth. So there was a pool and things. What did you pay then, and what is it now?
Oh,
just
God.
So that people.
Let me think back then. I don't know. Maybe $1.20, and depending on the unit now, they're, I want to say, 2.25. 240,
so they've
something
only,
like that.
They've only like doubled. That's not bad in 20 years.
No, they've not. It's actually a pretty well run place. They have some numbers, but some of these places that like have the golf course out here and everything, now you're looking at, you know, $450 a month for a two bedroom unit, and you know that's going to make a lot of people hesitate. That's a chunk of change. So well, I don't know. It's just sometime for first-time buyers, they think they want a condo or a townhome, but my buyer, she's reevaluating. She's like, well, maybe I'd rather have a smaller house and put that money from the maintenance fee towards a little house. Well, you still have to find a little house cheaper, and we did find a perfect one over the weekend, but it's a little bit of a stretch for her, so I actually have Nancy working on it with her, see if it's feasible. So there's a lot of trade-offs in this market, and you really just have to adjust your thinking about what you can't afford, but again, it's still better than renting, which is astronomical, off the charts. Yeah, I don't know if John's seen that, but rent is crazy.
Yeah, it's just.
Is that part of that? People don't want to take the risk, or there's got to be a massive difference in your whatever it is, your maintenance, your rent, or whatever, in a place that has a bunch of employees, like doormen and stuff, versus somebody else. I mean, your place didn't have any employees, right?
No, but it's just still, you know, it's still a huge, you know, especially if you're the landlord where it's the rent and the water, the heat and the water are included in the rent. And there's a lot of older buildings like that and some newer ones. So the landlord has to still cover their expenses and make some money. And that gets passed on. And a lot of people who are, you know, it's tough for people to get by, and then especially in that lower range. And you say all of a sudden, "Buy! I got to raise your rent to $100." You know, that could be like $1,000 to some people. So it's tough all the way around the board right now.
Well, the where I live, not saying my place, although I probably could. You know, it's a 100-year-old building with 4 apartments, and between the taxes, the water, and everything else all going up, to manage it, Jen, I'm not so sure if. If the owner gave it to me, I'd take it, to be honest with you.
And yeah. Taxes are so expensive there.
And I mean, the amount of age, I mean, even though I try and keep up with everything, I manage part of it.
Well, if you're paying, $35,000 taxes, you're going to make a lot of money.
That's
while right. For your neighborhood, you could charge a lot of money. You're right, the maintenance on that building, once you get those 100-year-old buildings, it's ongoing. I mean, that never stops.
Well, you end up doing the stuff you did, 15 years ago, and you think you're okay, and all of a sudden the air conditioning guy says, hey, you know that air conditioner is 15 years old? He goes, it is? Really?
Yep.
It doesn't seem like it's 15 years, but of course, the cost now is going to be three times it was 15 years ago. But, I mean, John, you are in a building that is, if you bought a four flat in Chicago now at the current price, can you make any money renting it? I don't think you can.
No, I know people in that kind of in that box right now, and it's a real problem for them to find qualified tenants.
Well, that's another issue. Yeah,
they spend a lot of time screening and worrying, because their expenses, the taxes have gone up, maintenance, new roof, any of this stuff has just blown their budget wide open for rental property or whether you live in it. And so they're stretched now to, to try to attract enough people when, they have to find tenants who are willing to, pay that or able to pay it, and not make a lot of demands too, because it's always about balancing what you, can defer or put off versus what you have to really knuckle down and figure out how to fix, or you're not going to get anybody to rent the place. And there's all these attendant costs now in getting repairs done and whatever, that have driven up the cost to a landlord that they're somehow going to have to pass on, because it's cutting into their ability to make their mortgage payment and to pay their tax bills on time too. So it's a real crunch for them, and I think it there's a tipping point at which they're going to have to make concessions and find somebody who's less qualified, or drop the rents and somehow sell some other asset to make up for the difference, just to hang on to the one that's more valuable. And that's a kind of a new thing, I think. I don't remember landlords being in that kind of spot, in the last 30 or 40 years when I've been following real estate.
Well, you see it everywhere. One of a good friend, listener to the show, he does a lot of commercial real estate. And I was telling you this, he says doing apartment buildings, bigger ones, is still an okay deal. But they're trying to thinking of building one up on Belmont and Western, somewhere, one of the majors, maybe it's Belmont and Ashland somewhere. And he said, how those buildings used to be apartments upstairs, and if it was on a main street, you had commercial downstairs, and they're looking for ways to basically bleep can the commercial and make those the first floor an okay apartment, which is a problem with security and stuff. But you can't rent out the commercial. I mean, you just drive down these streets. You go down Armitage, where it used to be really hot, or any of these streets, Halsted or whatever, the amount of vacancies is dramatic.
Every building that's been built like that in my neighborhood along Lawrence Avenue, and there's seven or eight of them near me that are, some are condos, some are rental, but they all envision, street-level commercial space, very attractive, And some of these buildings are not 10 years old. There's never been a tenant in any of these spaces.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
We were talking a little bit earlier before you came on, and we waited until you did, because you're the trying to draw a contrast to when the north side in Chicago, the near north side, was, I'll use the term.
Before you go there, I wanted to ask John about that. John, do you think that commercial space is, and I think, from what I've seen when I drive around, there's so many empty things. Do you think that it's unrealistic expectations from the owners of the commercial space? Why, they lose a tenant that's there because they want, all of a sudden, want to jack the rent up from 2,000 to 3,000, and the guy can't stay. I mean, what do you think about that phenomenon? Like, I'd rather have it empty for, 10 years than have a tenant paying something. I don't get it.
Yeah, I don't either. I think, the design, and this has been repeated over and over again, and it has been presented to, to the zoning board and stuff to get approval for it, that this will be an improvement for street level life, that this will bring, patrons there, this will make people want to shop there. There's parking provided for it. Should be adequate parking in some of these buildings, I think. But the idea was to create a new streetscape that on paper is just what you needed. But I think what they left out of the whole mixture was that trying to start up a business now or go into a spanking new rental space, if you're a struggling new business and paying top dollar for this space on a busy street, I don't think they realized just how few people there were who were in that position that they could, you know, afford a lease.
That's a great point, and I didn't think of that. I think that they're going back to maybe the times when you and I grew up and you walked to your little corner grocery store, your cleaners, your drugstores were walking distance. But those were all established neighborhoods. So to your point, I think the younger generation, A, they never had that great luxury of that, but now they're so used to, well, we're just going to go to a Costco, a Walmart, or Amazon. So Amazon is the go-to for every generation now. I think that, well, I don't need to go to the store when they can bring it to my house. So that little mom-and-pop store, I think, has less and less of a possibility of growing when it's hard for them to compete with a price of a major retailer, whether it's Amazon or Walmart.
That's exactly it. And, you know, the businesses that I've seen come and go in my neighborhood were coffee shops or sandwich places or whatever that you would want to succeed. And we need more of these places. But clearly, the people who are running the businesses can't afford the rent and produce an affordable meal for people, so they can't attract a dependable customer base if they're charging an arm and a leg for a cup of coffee or a sandwich. So
you can't go hang out there and get a $5 sandwich every day if you're retired or anything like that.
Right. Jen, so those businesses, they come and go. You 6 months, they're gone, and that space is empty again. I've seen this happen over and over.
Jen, is the, or maybe Audrey, you know, it's more of a tax question. The place I'm thinking about, Audrey, is the, what was the name of the breakfast place when I first moved into my area that it was the something two?
The one on the Clybourne?
Clybourne and Racine.
Oh, I don't remember the name, but they had great breakfast. That was great place.
It was a great place. There's lines out the door on weekends, and you know the place I'm talking about, Jan, because it had the...
Hunt Club?
No, you got your... No, that was across the street. You got your omelet on the...
Armitage. And
what's the place across from Union Station?
Mitchell's.
Yeah, it was Mitchell's too, right?
Yeah.
And, now these guys... successful business going, all of a sudden they're out. And I'm thinking, what the hell happened to them? And, well, of course, you know, you can learn everything at the Tripoli Tap, so I asked somebody in there, what happened to Mitchell's? They go, the guy raised the rent to $15,000 a month. The comment was, that's a hell of a lot of omelets. Now, my question, it probably laid, I'm going to use an agricultural term, it laid fallow for what, 5 years on?
At least.
Nobody in the place until finally some furniture outfit gets in there, and I can't believe they're paying $15,000 a month. But my question to you, John, is if I won't say dumb enough because those guys know the numbers better than me, if I boot somebody out, say he's paying $12,500 and I go, I need $15,000 or you're out, and the guy goes, I can't pay $15,000 and he leaves, all the fixtures, all that stuff, now all the infrastructure in the place is gone. It's just an empty hovel. You probably still got the plumbing, but if you let that sit for 5, 6, 7 years, are you paying taxes on it as if you were getting rent, or can you drop your taxes way down because there's no renter?
You could drop your taxes. You know, you can depreciate it. You can, depending on what's in there, you know, as far as fixtures or whatever that you...
Well, it ended up being empty.
Yeah, but I mean, you could certainly take a break on your income taxes. You know, for
Canada. Well, yeah, but I mean, your property taxes.
But not for property taxes, unless it was taxed separately for the tenant who, you know, was receiving the tax bill. You will probably get a break out of it because it's vacant and it's not occupied, and maybe, you know, for whatever reasons, it's a business climate where you can't get a tenant in there. So you can probably get something knocked off of your real estate bill.
What do you suppose, just out of grins, because we got a dash here. When it was a going concern, I'd say the rent was $12,500 a month the guy was paying. What do you suppose the taxes would be? Would it be $5,000, $4,000?
You know what? I would not have an idea about commercial at all, but I still shake my head. It's like, you got $12,500 and you want $15,000. wouldn't you search around for a tenant on the sly before you even say that to somebody? I think that's common sense. You don't just like, well, I'm going to an established business house who's never missed a payment, has been great for how many years, and let's just bet on the come. I just don't get it.
Well, next week, next time you're on, what do you suppose would happen if somebody, it's maybe a great question, if we did a survey / doctoral paper, how much do you think the parking meters have affected this kind of stuff?
Oh, God. Huge.
I think huge.
Oh, yeah. It's too annoying. You just move on and go someplace you can park in a lot.
Right.
Anyway, thank you, guys. SP Futures up 37. We're hanging in here, so maybe we'll have an update. NASDAQ Futures up 145. Thank you, Greg. We'll be back tomorrow. Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.